is impossible. Nothing's really out of reach. All your silent secret longings wait for you somewhere. If you dare to believe.
Welcome to Creative Conversations with Dr. Sue. I'm Dr. Sue, and you've been listening to my song, If You Dare to Believe, a song about the power of creativity. Today we're going to have a conversation with an extremely creative person, producer, director, writer, cinematographer, Rick McKay. Rick is best known for his award-winning documentary, Broadway, The Golden Age. This amazing documentary about the living legends of Broadway took top prize in over 15 film festivals and is a smash hit on public television as part of their fundraising drive. Rick also won over 30 Emmy Awards for WNET 13 City Arts, plus 3 Telly Awards. He helped create the opening segment for 2 recent Tony Award broadcasts, produced episodes for Arts and Entertainment Network, HBO, and United Artists. Rick is also a very warm, smart, fun guy. I know you're going to enjoy meeting him. In the words of that song from the Broadway musical, The King and I, I'm looking forward to getting to know you. So welcome to Creative Conversations, and hello, Rick McKay.
Hi, Dr. Sue. It's nice to be here.
It's so nice to have you on my show. I've seen you on public television, so I knew what you were going to look like, so I'm all excited to have you on the show.
It's fun to be here. I think it's great what you're doing.
I'm happy with doing a show that's creative and that's positive and that, you know, people will really enjoy. And let's talk about your most famous film, which is Broadway, The Golden Age. And what era do you consider the Golden Age of Broadway?
Well, I made it a point to not decide what the Golden Age was, to because I left PBS, actually, to make this film independently, which was a big leap. And I decided to do something I don't do very well, and that's shut up and just listen. And I let people talk and talk and talk, because when you have a crew and you work for someone else, you try to fit in as many interviews as you can in the day. Sometimes, like when I was a biography, we'd do 2 in the morning, 2 in the afternoon. We'd drive around the city with a crew racing to each interview. But I would have people come to my house, and I would just let them go. And sometimes people would talk for 3-4 hours. So I actually found old Russian proverb. It was just 5 words when I started the film, and it said, the work will teach you. The work will teach you. I blew it up, and I put it above my bathroom mirror. So every morning when I brushed my teeth, I looked at it, and I thought, I'll let this film tell me what it's supposed to be. Because traditionally in this business, especially when you're for hire as a producer or director, you have to draw out an arc and the entire story in advance. Then you go, even in a documentary, and you try and get people to say what you need. Often one of my editors would tell me, I'm stuck at this one point. The next person, could you get them to give us a laundry list, saying a list of all these things, because that'll get me out of trouble with this transition. So you would tell people what you need them to say in many ways, but still remain open to other things. But I decided to not do any of that and let them just really tell me what it was. And so they told me what the Golden Age was, and many found it to be basically between 2 wars, and not the wars you would think. It was really not between World War I and II or whatever. It was between World War II and Vietnam.
Ah, yes, I know.
Tended to be the Golden Age.
Right.
And it's, I like to stress to people also, it's a Golden Age, not the only Golden Age. And also I stress to people that the world is supposed to change. This film is not a lament to a lost era and how everything stinks now. Quite the contrary, if the world didn't change, we would still be doing Gilbert and Sullivan shows exclusively. And Stephen Sondheim never would have gotten a job, or Rodgers and Hart, or Rodgers and Hammerstein, or Cole Porter, or any of those people that created that era. It's always time for one generation to step back and let another generation come in. But because this happened on the New York stage within 10, 15 blocks of real estate, it was more like a freak era, in my opinion. And because it happened live every night, it wasn't documented. The unions didn't permit you to film it.
Oh, that's right. There's a strong union prohibition on that.
And I thought it was important not to make the movie to show people that it was a better time, but to make the movie because just because you dedicate your life to live performance does not mean it should be forgotten and
That's
disappear.
Right. That's what's so important, because otherwise people don't even know that these people originated the role, sometimes did a brilliant job with it. If they weren't in the movie version, they could be lost.
Exactly. And any kid can discover at Blockbuster or Hollywood Video or Netflix classic film, or they can turn to Turner Classic Movies, and Robert Osborne will even walk you down the whole experience and educate you before each film and tell you stories about how it came to be. Mm-hmm. But as far as the theater goes, a kid can't discover what happened in a theater, especially in a play. There are no cast albums of plays, only of musicals.
Right. So with a play, it really disappears.
That's why the film, I also made a conscious decision not to do what most people do, which is the golden age of musicals. I decided to not treat musicals any differently than plays, to treat it as one community, all telling the same stories. Some told them in rhythm, some didn't. Yeah. Some had musical accompaniment, some didn't. But it's about the community. So, you know, you see Marlon Brando bumping against Gwen Verdon and West Side Story against Kim Stanley in this film,
right,
you know,
right.
Tennessee Williams and Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Right. That's right, because that is what was happening. There was no distinction.
Next door to each other. They were across the street. You'd walk up down the street, and there were as many plays as there were musicals.
Right, which is not true now at all.
No, now there's lag. It was last fall there was one play on Broadway.
That's right.
One play at one point.
And from your point of view, why do you think that's true?
Because producers believe in giving people what they think they want, and it has become so outrageously expensive to go to the theater that they think people want value, and they think value is perceived as a large cast in glitzy costumes with effects and chandeliers and Cadillacs and helicopters. They think bigger is better, and if you're going to charge people over $100 now, you better give them, show them where the money goes.
And maybe there's also a question about language, because to enjoy a play, you have to be able to understand language on a sophisticated level.
Well, not only understand on a sophisticated level, but in my opinion, musicals today, some producer along the way made a decision, or some consortium of producers, and language is taken out of most musicals now.
Minimized.
Well, I think the intention is that one can play anywhere in the world inexpensively without having to translate it. And two, even in New York, if you have a Japanese tourist and a couple from New Jersey and a German tourist, they're all having the same experience because they're listening to ABBA songs with a threadbare plot. Or the Beach Boys.
That is often true. That's not 100% true, but often true.
No, but if it's not true, then for many years it's dying now, thank God. But the theory was take a book that everybody read, that was they were forced to read in primary school, whether it be Jane Eyre or whether it was an opera, La Boheme, that they saw, or whether it was Madame Butterfly. You know, it just translated, turned it into Miss Saigon, because they think they come to the theater already knowing the story. We don't even have to tell the story. Think how easy.
Well, it's a selling point. They've got a selling point.
Well, they don't need language.
Yeah.
The audience has done the work before. And then when that started to get boring and audiences got tired of it, they said, well, now maybe we could not only skip the story, what if we skip the composers? There must be dead composers. We could just license their whole catalog. Now we'll take all the songs and how do we string them together?
Right.
You know, there was something recently, I think it was that Elvis Presley musical that ran for a while at the Palace Theater, and they even based it on a Shakespeare play, so they didn't even have to pay the playwright.
Oh, well, that,
I mean, they took the Elvis Presley songs, and then they took a dead playwright, Shakespeare, who's in public domain, and used one of his plays and modernized it. I thought, God forbid you bring in a brand new, fresh, creative team. Look at West Side Story. Look at Gypsy. I mean, we're talking about young Stephen Sondheim, Leonard Bernstein, young Jerry Robbins, young Arthur Lawrence.
And doing really new
young
things.
Young people do it,
really,
yeah.
Really new things that our ears are not yet accustomed to all those sounds.
Yeah, and the book writer, Arthur Lawrence, was an esteemed young 35-year-old writer. I mean, they treated the book to a musical with as much respect as they did the music.
That's right. And these people, they were young. So even when the surface, the commercial surface is what we see, but what we don't see is all the struggle underneath, the invisible people, the people who are creating the theater of tomorrow. And your film begins with the struggle. And I understand that some people advised you to cut that out of the film. Don't put in the struggle that people had in theater. But you insisted on keeping it in.
Well, when you listen to Carol Burnett sit down and tell you how five girls had to share one room. Because
right.
she was so naive, she went right to the Algonquin Hotel, and it cost $9 a night, almost, you know, the whole rent she had paid with her mother back home. So when she tells you five girls shared one room and then they pitched in $5 each and bought one dress and shared it, when you hear those stories, it's so inspiring. And I find young audiences that come to New York and are struggling, that just got out of school and come here because it's their dream to, you know, make a career here, when they hear Carol Burnett telling those stories, they really...
Sure,
when,
and it,
they
you
all
know,
tell them. They all have the same experience.
And it's fun, too. When you have to split a dress four ways, there's a bond, and there's a fun, and there's a sense we're all in this together. You know,
it's true. You have to use your imagination.
Yeah, and with I believe with everything, there's a plus and there's a minus. So the plus for having a lot of money is you can buy a fancy dress. But the minus is you don't have that bond, that community. That, oh, look, we got this one. I'm going out. You're going out. We're all in it together. And that's the kind of fun that you can't buy.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah. So, you know, we're going to go to break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to listen to Carol Burnett sing a song from the show that got her over, the show Once Upon a Mattress.
That's right.
Okay. So stay with us.